This is the Living Legacy Project at the Birchfield Penny Art Center, and I'm here today with Kyle Butler, and it is September 1st, 2016. Kyle, thank you so much for coming in to join me today.
Thank you.
So, Kyle, this is a very generic question in a lot of ways and often over-asked, but what inspired you to want to be an artist?
So, I didn't immediately, when most people make that decision or like when you decide to be an artist, it's usually like along the career sense of the word, when you get to college, what are you going to do? What are you going to pursue when you're out of college? And like prior to that, I was always doing things. I was always making stuff. I didn't grow up knowing too much about the contemporary art world, so I can't say that, you know, anything beyond like the generic canon of people that anybody would know from art history. Maybe a handful of other people, but I wasn't necessarily too in tune with that world growing up. But I was always making stuff, and I had kind of like an agitated mind, and that just kind of kept, that was sort of like a mental companion of mine throughout the years. It was like being someone that would kind of just react to things by either making drawings or like making some weird structure in the backyard with neighbor kids or something. Once I got to college, though, I was kind of like resistant to the idea of committing to one life trajectory or another, so I just for 2 years took whatever classes. Didn't sign up for college on my own. Someone signed up for me because they didn't want me to not go to college. And then 2 years into it, I had an instructor that became a really big influence on me. His name's Brian Elder, my drawing teacher. He pulled me aside and he was like, hey, you have kind of an aptitude for this. Have you ever considered doing it? And I was like, well, it's always been a thing that I've done. But kind of from that point on, I decided like, all right, this could be an interesting enough career choice. Like, I'll go with this. And so just sort of followed that line of thought, went to grad school here in Buffalo. That teacher that I just mentioned was in Michigan at Central Michigan University. I went to grad school here at Buffalo, and then I've just been kind of like riding it since then, I suppose, with, you know, different financial ups and downs over the years. But it's a tough question for me just because inspiration seems like a conflicting word. Like, inspiration is a part of it, but it's also habit and compulsion and maybe even anxiety at times. Like, there's a soup of thing that goes into why you might feel compelled to like make something versus however else you could spend your time. So it's a mix of all those things, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I have found, yeah, and it's a intentionally like broad and almost misleading question at some points, you know, because some people never decided, they just did, you know,
right.
Other people were super intentional and knew from a young age that they wanted this path. You know, in all those ways.
Like, I mean, you could also answer it by saying, like, it's really fun. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of another, like, base level justification.
Absolutely.
It's the most entertaining way to spend my time.
Yeah. And so you enjoy it?
Yeah, oh yeah, totally.
Awesome.
The art world is the funnest story, I think.
I completely agree. You mentioned that it was a professor who kind of pushed you in the right direction and where you went to school, but can you speak on that more? Where you did your undergraduate and then what it was like doing grad work? Getting your MFA, right?
Yeah.
Here in Buffalo?
Sure, yeah. So undergrad, that was Central Michigan University. That was in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. As far as like Central Michigan goes, there was a fair amount going on, but it was still a really smaller town. Large school, though, but a small art program. So, you know, it had a very different feel from UB, which I would imagine would have a very different feel from a place like, you know, one of the premier private art schools. Like, it wasn't quite as intense or as quite as competitive, but it was still a great experience. Like, and there was this pretty strong community at the time that was doing a lot of like organizing of events and like helping each other realize projects. So like, as far as I'm concerned, it was everything that I needed out of a school, and I had some pretty phenomenal teachers like Brian, the one that I had mentioned, and I'm hesitant to mention too many more just because I don't want to leave anybody out. But some of them I've kept in touch with and I'm even like collaborating with now. Dietmar Krumery is one that comes to mind, that we've got a performance thing coming up. But it was all in all a good experience. I had like a moment where I had like a little bit of a crisis where I thought like, if I'm going to do the art thing, do I got to go to a private art school? Like, that seems to be what the media says that you should do. And so I went and I took a class at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, just like one summer course. And it was phenomenal, but it was also like, you know, first time in a larger city. So I kind of just like, to a degree, dicked around a little bit. Made a lot of stuff, but also just spent a lot of time playing around in Chicago. But at the end of the class, I thought, like, this is great, but the cost is kind of insane. So I toughed it out, at CMU, totally happy with my experience, and then left for Buffalo and went to University at Buffalo for the master's program. And like, I think I sort of lucked out in that experience just because the other five people that were in the program in my year and then the people that were second years in the program were all really tight-knit as well. So it was an easy transition from undergrad, like leaving one community but immediately stepping into another. And I don't know that it's always like that amongst like immediate grad students. So, you know, same deal, great teachers, great colleagues, and that's all kind of generic, but it was a positive experience. So I don't have much criticism of it.
And what program did you go to UB for?
That was in visual studies, and they've since changed it back to just being art, the name of the department. But yeah, at the time it was visual studies, which is virtually equivalent to art.
And is it normal for the class size to be that small for each incoming class? I guess I kind of never put that together.
Not always. It usually alternates big and small. Like, so 1 year will be 12, 1 year will be 5 or 6. I think they've grown a bit since then. Like, there's more students now. They might even have a class as high as, like, 15 to 18 or something. But it's usually about that. It has kind of an ebb and flow, alternating years.
What was it like going from Michigan to the University of Buffalo? Which, especially North Campus, I find to be, that was one of my considerations for why I didn't go there. I had such a hard time feeling connected there, and so it's really exciting to hear that you found connection there, because to me it's such a, it feels very sterile.
It's sterile, yeah, but, I mean, especially the arts building, like, at the time it was before they started doing murals inside and such, so it was, like, entirely white, kind of an alienating place. But they give you your own studio with your key and you can lock your door. So, like, I was part of a contingent of people that was, like, sleeping there half the week. And then we'd hang out in the middle of the night. So it became home. We became, like, very familiar with the food court and the Indian food place. I think that the environment is, like, not necessarily the most compelling for a bunch of artists to spend time in. But we managed to kind of make it our own space, especially, like, within the kind of studio culture in the place.
What year did you graduate?
2010.
Who are some people who have influenced you, either through direct interaction or through their work, like maybe, you know, inspirations you've never met?
One guy jumps out, and he is an artist. He's more so a musician. He's a guy from Michigan named Mike Johnston. Worked at a record store with him, and he's quite a bit older than me. He's maybe in his 50s, maybe even going on to his 60s. But he was always this important character in my life where, like, you know, like, I grew up kind of going to that record store and talking to him about music, and he'd give me, like, weird suggestions, check out this album or check out this bizarre CD, and then eventually worked there, and then eventually worked at a radio station doing jazz programming with him. And we've kept in touch over the years, but he's always been this sort of, like, voice of reason in my, like, development and figuring out what exactly is going on with the cultural world and how do I respond to it or locate myself within it, just because he's had so much more experience and he's always been approaching it from a sort of dissenter's viewpoint. Like, he's always made very out music and very decidedly out photography work as well, but also has, like, a nearly complete lack of ego. So, like, he gave great criticism, but he also wasn't too caught up in, like, the identity politics of being an artist. So that's one person that comes to mind. As far as, like, influences from the larger art world, like people I haven't met, people from art history, there's a few I can name out, and it's usually more a matter of people that I seem most attracted to have some strange mix between, like, the context in which they made the work and also how that informs the work that they made. And the first name that always comes to mind is this guy named Stuart Sherman. And I haven't even seen that many of his videos, but he was this, like, performance artist sort that would set up a card table in usually Central Park, but he lived in New York for a while, and would do these strange little interactions with props, and it was kind of you could tell it was a really deliberate sequence of actions that he would go through, and then it had things that vaguely seemed like symbolic or metaphorical, but never quite that. But there seemed to me something really profound about how difficult it probably, I would imagine, was for people to get into that, but how much conviction he had doing it. And also, like, there was this always underlying, like, enormous humor to it that he would never let on to, but kind of, like, if you were into it, was still apparent. So he's someone that has resonated with me, even, again, I've only seen a couple of his pieces.
Can I ask what resonates about him with you? Is it the performative aspect, or is it the like hidden joke aspect, or is it the intentionality?
I think the hidden joke is sort of just more of an added bonus. The way that he conducts himself, like it's immediately apparent that he's got this conviction to it, or that there's a structure to it, despite everything that he's doing seemingly being just nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like that pairing of things, like that he was privy to this world of meaning and of organizing his actions that we can only get glimpses into. And so one thing I learned from him is that I don't mind if I don't necessarily entirely understand through and through a piece. Like, I can still garner great import from it, even if it's sort of opaque. And like, that's something that I've sort of taken to heart, where I'm not entirely concerned with, nor do I even have any faith in my ability to, like, in its entirety communicate a whole idea to somebody via the objects that I make. So I try to revel a little bit in them being, like, flawed and fatally falling short on their ability to communicate an idea,
mm-hmm.
and then turning that into its own sort of, like, working material of illegibility. Not illegible entirely, but, like, shooting for, like, little fragments of meaning and significance and apparent idea amidst what is otherwise sort of a noise.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that from your conversations with people who enjoy your work, do you feel that comes across? Like, do you ever see that in the viewer, sort of the enjoying the unknown and the known sort of?
I think it's hard to really get a good gauge on, like, what an average view of the things that I made would be. Like, pretty often, like, I've switched the materials that I've used over the years and I've changed processes, and usually I try to make things so that the way in which they were made is itself not entirely apparent. So often the questions I get are more so along, like, oh, how did you make this? What did you use? How did you make this mark or this surface texture? Which is sort of related to that. I think I'm not the most, like, empathetic writer. That's the thing I could work on. So when it comes to, like, contextualizing the stuff that I make, I'm not throwing enough bones to the viewer. And so often I'll get these sort of, like, head scratching, like, so you're trying to do this one thing you said, and how does that relate to the image? And I'm not sure if people are just straight up annoyed by that, or if that they're still amused despite that. Not all the times. I mean, that's not to say that they're, like, way complicated, or they're not at all beyond anybody. That's not at all what they are. But there's something, like, that gets scrambled in my communication when I'm making the object.
Mm-hmm.
That hopefully people are still into it despite that. It seems like it, because most feedback I've gotten over the years has been very positive. But I know that there's, like, a good percentage of, you know, the intention that is lost in translation,
mm-hmm.
which is fine.
I can speak, you know, I know, like, especially in Buffalo, there's a lot of love for you here and a lot of love for your work. And that's what I tend to encounter when I encounter your works in, like, a gallery setting or something like that. But when Poised on All Edges, that was kind of a very different shift for you, going to work in sort of that style with, you know, very angular edges,
mm-hmm.
and geometric sort of forms. And I think what I've enjoyed from seeing your different transitions and I won't even say progression, because I think that's a sort of a very Western flawed concept of progression towards something, you know,
mm-hmm.
instead it's just like, well, here's all these different things, you know, can it just be a node? Can it just be, like, rather than linear, can it be just sort of an accumulation? But it is exciting to see all the different ways you can play with different media.
Thank you.
Feedback.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I mean, I like what you say about it being a node rather than a step towards something, because, like, yeah, and to me, like, the had distinct shifts. Like, you know, every year I get sick of the paintings I was doing, and I go on to some. I try to figure out what's another thing that I can do that'll hold my attention. And I do that for a while, and then I switch to the next thing. But they don't. Yeah, they don't. Sometimes they're different enough that, like, there's not even much of a point in relating the previous series with the next, other than the fact that they came from me, so they have some, like, process resemblances and some conceptual through lines, but they otherwise feel very different. But I sort of anticipate that at some point all these things will kind of come back around, where, like, I'll get tired of switching gears quite so often, and I'll go revisit a past work. So I sort of assume that, you know, from the last, whatever, 6 years, or I've been in Buffalo 8 years, from that 8 years of, like, shifting gears a couple of times, that stuff will return at the least, but hopefully start to, like, blend together in ways that
mm-hmm.
are new to me.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So I just saw your installation at the Buffalo Niagara International Hostel, and at first I didn't realize it was you because it's this very sculptural installation of chain link fence, and I'm describing it mostly for the people who are listening to it in the future from right now. But it felt very playful, and it was that playful quality that sort of said, "Oh yeah, that's Kyle," for me. Even though it was, you know, a departure from both the works we have here in the museum and previous sort of series I've seen you work in. You've mentioned a few times that you enjoy performance art and the performative aspect and also the illustrative quality that sort of is what drew you into the fine art field. And so there's illustration, there's performance, there's sculpture, there's, you know, geometry and almost woodwork in some ways. Can you talk about that broad picture of what you create and why you create it?
I feel like to sufficiently answer that, I would have to like go back and examine all these tiny little impulses and prompts that I've had over, you know, my 31-year lifetime. That's a little dumb and broad, but like just to, because it feels like a lot of these ideas come out of like very small things. Like for whatever reason, I'm reading or looking at something or just walking around, and an idea that was maybe kind of floating around my head begins to click a bit more, and then I just sort of act on it. Or it's like a material. You know, I'm walking around the store and I see a material and it lends an idea and I'll act on that. So like there's a whole landscape of small, tiny impulses that lead to like why I would take on these larger projects. But despite that, it's not entirely just like this me walking around going, oh, I'm reacting to this thing. There's a lot of like tendencies, I would say, more so than concepts that keep coming up a lot. And that might be like sort of the type of work behavior or like studio ethic that I'm inclined towards, or even like the time to the type of like mental space that I'm tolerant of when it comes into like putting in labor towards making something finished. And so to maybe try to pinpoint a couple of them, like I know that I have a lot of tolerance for like repetitive, laborious, lengthy tasks. I know that there's certain realms of thought that I like that I have come in and out of the work a lot, like for the one painting we looked at earlier, like the sort of fragmentation of imagery, or like I was talking about a bit ago, considering the potential illegibility of a piece as its own like material aspect of it, and then how to like wield that in certain ways. And then to elaborate on the fragmentation idea, I often come back to the idea of like considering like an area in which the piece is going to occur. And for those of you in audio world, I just made a square with my hands to indicate the area. It was a rectangle. You know, as if that's the painted surface. But I have a habit of like subdividing that surface or that area in which like, you know, the artwork will take place into smaller areas, and then systematically problem solving within those areas, almost like not as strict as an algorithm, but kind of like that. Like I'm kind of a very rule-based artist. Like this is arbitrarily the rules I've set for this process or this type of work, and then I have to sort of carry it out to its conclusion. And that sort of thinking of carrying out the algorithm to its conclusion is usually what drives like a series of work. Like, oh, these 15 paintings kind of developed the way that I did because I finished one and thought like, well, of course, this would be the next step, so I'll do that, and then the next, and then the next. So those kinds of like impulses and tendencies are usually, I would argue, what constitutes, you know, like my working process or why I create something or how.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Do you write out your rules? Like, you know, I'm thinking about this from an archival perspective, right? 50 years from now, is there going to be enough of a roadmap to look at maybe the different projects you've worked on or the series you've worked in and be able to apply or to identify the rules you worked by within each?
Maybe to a degree. I'm really bad at documenting my life, whether mm-hmm. it's photos or notes. But I do have a lot of sketchbooks, and I've started to become a bit more like deliberate about keeping track of what my rules were for a time, because I've found that over the years, like if I want to go back and sort of get in the same mental space that I was in when I made something, you know, say 2 years ago, it feels like it takes a long time of just examining those like images of those paintings that I made to figure out like what exactly, aside from like basic aspects of them, like what exactly was the larger motivation or the larger system to it. And there's always things that I realize, like, oh, I forgot that this was like one of the, you know, rules or the considerations of it. So like with a series that I did kind of recently, like in the last year and a half of paintings, I started to actually document, like, say, the different types of marks and like sort of name them and catalog them. And it's nowhere near sufficient or even usable, or like from the archivist standpoint, like you can't really navigate through it too much, but hopefully someday. But I have a suspicion that it'll always be like the equivalent of a messy desk full of papers that someone might have to fish through to figure out, you know, where the treasure map is.
And that mess is part of the roadmap in a lot of ways. I mean, from an archival perspective, one of the basic principles, you know, that you adhere to everywhere possible is original order, right? So whatever order, chaotic seeming or not, if there is a discernible order to it, even if it's not what, you know, I would say is the most organized order,
mm-hmm.
you keep it in that way because it tells you about the artist's thought process, or it tells you about the creator's thought process, right? So long as that's all those piles on your desk, the conceptual desk,
mm-hmm.
you know, even if they're overlapping and everything, if they're piles that you intentionally put them in, you keep them in those piles because it tells the future about how you worked.
Right.
You know, when you were mentioning sort of cataloging your own symbols and stuff like that, it did make me think of Charles Birchfield. Have you ever seen his conventions for abstract thought?
I don't think so.
When he was a young man, when he was like early 20s, he was very depressed and, or very, very, I don't know, morose, is that the word? Is that a word? Didn't make
mm-hmm.
that word up. But just, yeah, just a very melancholy person. And so he came up with these symbols that he called his conventions for abstract thought. And one looks like kind of an upside down W, and
they're
like other
sort of
ones,
letter form like?
Kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah. I think I've seen some of these.
Yeah. And he had terms for them like morbid brooding. And, you know, one is something like the sense of a thing recognizing that it will die, or something like that, you know, just
mm-hmm.
that realization, but symbolized. And even, and in his early works, you can kind of see them all over the place. They're in the windows of houses.
Right, and plants that radiate a certain, the plant itself is in that symbol
mm-hmm,
shape. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But he still continued doing that all the way to the end of his life in different ways, even in really like what we conceive of as positive or uplifting or radiant works, you know, but still has these little hints to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you can, even if at that point he didn't even know he was doing it anymore, not doing it consciously, he was still including these, you know, his own catalog sort of meaning structure within his works for much of his life. And it's just, it's really beautiful being able to see that. You know, it's not a one-to-one connection, but you can get the sense of it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he, like, his line work, you know, the way that he painted, especially the way looser stuff, it already had these implications of like language or feel or like intention. And I say this in sort of a selfish way, and that's the way that I often think about mark making, is that it's a total parallel to like conduct or posture or the like, where, you know, you hypothetically could read somebody via their posture or via their marks that they make. And so like Birchfield already had all that stuff embedded in it. Maybe not as legible, but it's interesting that he went as far as like, here's my explicit language for this stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think he started very explicit and then became more loose with it as he aged and
yeah.
grew and stuff like that. But Charlie was an archivist dreamboat. He
yeah.
really was. There's just, it's everything. You know, I talk about original order. He grouped his sketches, you know, based on feelings or motifs or themes or stuff like that, and he would also group it by like a specific tree or something, but if it was a motif or a theme, he would add sketches to that folder his whole life, you know. And so rather than pull everything out and put it all chronologically, we keep it in his original order, so we still folder all of his sketches based on his own notations. I think we have 570 folders, you know.
Wow.
For all that. Yeah.
To contrast with that, I've gotten to the habit of, in my sketchbooks, I always buy the same sketchbooks, and I don't ever go from one page to the next. I just go to random pages, and eventually it gets filled up, but it's like I'm filling in all the gaps in the larger rocks. So it is not at all an archivist's dream, because I didn't like the pressure of like, okay, next page, I didn't like that every, things didn't necessarily happen quite so tidily, and so I felt like I had to just explode the sketchbook so that I wasn't stressed out by like the obligation of the next page.
It's a very good way of putting it. And really, and so long as that information is known and can be like, I'm speaking from an archival perspective, but you know, if we had a collection like that in the archives, so long as I could tell a researcher that this artist didn't work chronologically, you know, and don't expect to find that, that's all you really need to do, you know. But if you have an assumption of chronology and you apply it to something that doesn't work that way, then you come up with a sort of false conclusion.
Yeah, right.
Can I ask you about the piece? Is it still at the hostel, or
yeah.
is it?
Yeah, it's up for another 2 weeks or so.
So was that a one-off for that space specifically, or is it kind of in a body that you're working in?
It's in, so there was a number of years ago, I did a show in Buffalo at a place called Hallwells Contemporary Arts Center. And in that, there was a number of large sculptures, three of which were these chain link fence pieces. And they weren't huge, like the biggest was maybe 3 by 6 feet or 4 by 6 feet. And it had like chain link fence where I cut the bottoms, straightened them out, and then put them into, embedded them in pieces of wood so that the fencing stood upright. And it made this sort of like mathematical, you know, organic for fencing anyway, array of fences that like kind of grew upward across the sequence and then grew back down and split. And then two other fence pieces that each were cut from out around town in Buffalo, pieces of fence that had wood that had grown through them and then had been cut on both sides so that it was just the wood and the fence. And I liked those pieces. I liked working with the fence because like with my draw toward like systematic ways of working, the fencing is sort of perfect for that. Like it's comes in these cells, like it is just wire, but because of how it's bent, you're forced to like make these hard-edged incremental decisions in how you work with it, but then finding ways to make it not feel so stiff and rigid, especially in comparison to how you usually see it. And I like redid my website this past summer, and it's like a total recipe for hating everything you've ever done. But I was looking at those fence pieces and I thought, like, there's only the three of them, they're not really enough to constitute a body of work. And so I'd been meaning to get back to that at some point and do like a much larger version of it, and in a way to like retroactively legitimize those ones that I'd done before. And so it seemed like a good opportunity. Like this gallery that it's in is just one big open space, not really that suitable for 2D works, for wall works, just because it's not, there's not that many walls for one. Half the gallery is giant windows. And it's basically just one long room. So it seemed like a good setup to try out one of these like larger scale fence pieces.
Mm-hmm. I think it was really effective.
Thanks.
Yeah. Is there any more you can say on different themes that have emerged, either within, from what I'm getting from talking with you, is that you're very technically focused. You're very focused on a lot of the different skills that you're using in achieving different bodies of work, let's say, and like playing with those techniques and playing with what your specific ways of using techniques are.
I think that was a good description of how I work, for sure, but there's been ways in which I felt like I've been surprised at the like how I handled working on a project, and more so in recent years, and then more so with like performance art stuff. Like for some reason, the way that my brain works when it's considering how to handle a performance, it's still very like rigid in a lot of ways, and it wants to latch onto some sort of like distinct process that or system or kind of equation for carrying the performance from beginning to end. But at the same time, like I become really impulsive in terms of the content that I put into it, almost on the verge of like something like a Mad Lib. And what I kind of realized was that there was all this like, there was a lot of potential in that, and there was a lot of like what seemed to be consistent like information or themes that come out of that impulse. Like, duh, of course it's like a, despite it impulse and despite the connotation of that, it still is coming from like some pretty distinct anchors within your own mind. And so like there's bound to be some reliably some sort of like continuity there, even if you often act on impulse. And so like in doing the couple of performance things that I did now with painting, I'm a lot more inclined, for example, to like just be like, I don't know why, but this seems to be like the right idea that mm-hmm. I should go with next. And so then I'll just run with it. And that, excitingly enough, for me anyway, has been growing over the years, where I'm actually disinclined to map out entirely the concept behind, you know, whatever the series is, painting, performance, sculpture, beforehand, because I kind of want to just like swim around in that ambiguous sea for a bit, make some stuff, and then figure it out later, or not, or just react by doing the next thing. So it's become a weird mix between like a very systematic brain that really wants that kind of order and control, and then this like antagonistic little kid in my head that's like, well, screw it, I'm just gonna like do this thing because it seems like it'll work and it'll feel good.
Well, I'm glad you've gotten to that place in some ways, because sometimes if you stay too long in the rigid structure for decades, it can lead to a very very black and white way of viewing the world, maybe.
Yeah, and with making stuff, it can lead to, like, stuff that only becomes, when it's not that it's bad, but too formal of work. Like, I don't want it just to be like, I made this crazy process and look at the result of it. That's interesting, but I feel like I have to restrict that aspect of it a bit, otherwise it grows out of control.
Can you speak a little bit more about performance art and how you and some of the performance art pieces you've done or been interested in doing?
Sure. Like, in the more distant past, I did a number of, like, really small things, and it was always like maybe a little heavy-handed on the symbolism, but like material heavy and not necessarily like physical in the same sense that like endurance performance artists would do something physical. But it was more toward that than it was toward like a really slow contemplative performance. And for me, like, I did these things, but nothing ever really seemed to have a lot of continuity until I did this thing in Toronto a couple years ago, this like 12-hour performance that was a series of sort of like drywall and stud forms or boxes or walls. They were all built to specification to cater to a certain like series of actions where I'd break stuff out of the walls, either build something or just interact with the props, and make something new outside of the walls from the objects that were inside of it. And, you know, 12 hours, it was 12 episodes, and then there was, I think, 9 different drywall and stud wall forms. And that was both like intensely organized, like there was so much planning that had to go into it, but also like very impulsive, like I was just saying, in that, like, in terms when it came to figure out what exactly is it that I'm doing with these individual moments amongst this 12 hours, I got very loose with it. And then I just sort of like added up the conceptual total once all these ideas kind of came out. And that has since then sort of set the tone. Like, I did another performance, but just for a camera, so it was more of a video document along those lines a year ago. Same idea, but trying to figure out how it would go, and I started mixing it with like the painting work, in the sense that the performance for the camera made this thing that was a two-dimensional plane that sort of faced the camera. So I'm not really sure where it'll go from there. There's another thing coming up, a collaboration with a friend of mine, where it's going to be like a meeting of those impulses that I was just sort of talking about, and this is his own. So like, hopefully that'll push it in an even different direction.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like too, with that, it's like you're defining the structure to allow yourself to have the undefined space, you know? So you're like setting up the scene and then letting it sort of play through however it's going to play through.
Yeah. And then sort of justifying it with choreography. Like, if, you know, the more, I kind of feel like the more disparate the objects or the actions, the objects I pull from the wall or the actions I undergo with those, the more disparate they are, the more like tight the choreography has to be in order to like maintain from one direction or the other some semblance of order to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. What was that piece called in Toronto?
Phrases Toward Rephrase.
You know, looking at the diverse media you work in, is your technical creative process is probably different when you're working with illustration or painting or sculpture or these sorts of things. And it seems like your adherence loosely or tightly to structures might be consistent between all those?
To a degree, yeah. There's enough one-offs that defy that, but that's a safe bet that structures or systems are something that is consistent throughout.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to talk about creative process just in the sense that it's changed so much over the years, and then I've jumped around a bit. And so I guess, like, as far as things that carry on between them, like those sorts of themes or tactics, I guess, you know, very systematic working would be one thing that carries through. But also just my own little personality tendencies are things that carry through. So, like, I can kind of see allegiances between these disparate bodies of work, but just because I can kind of get, you know, I can get back to my head where I was when I made them and think, like, okay, I can kind of see, like, of course that and that came from the same person because you have this such and such brain makeup.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time articulating that though. Like, I wouldn't know what exactly to point out as far as like, oh, these are the personality traits that seem to be apparent in each of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not to mention, would anyone else see those connections if they're not you?
Yeah.
And also you, the same you who made the works.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about maybe how your creative process has changed from maybe your time graduating from UB to now?
Yeah, mostly the shift has been away from too concrete of a conceptual structure behind the work. Like the stuff that I was doing in grad school, I feel like when I say that, it probably sounds like a cop out, like I'm trying to get out of articulating what I do. But in grad school, I was doing stuff that was had to do with the built environment, and Buffalo certainly was an influence in that, just because of the situation it was in. It had been so long in such poor shape, and I liked that environment just in the sense of how it, you know, humanity wears on its sleeve all of its failures and biases and successes, and so like that's all embedded in the environment that we live in, and it's a lot more amplified in a city than it is in the country, or it's all that information is a lot more immediate. So like all the stuff I was doing was around built environment and like urban sociology. I was studying a fair amount, but I was tying everything to like these really explicit concepts. Like each painting was almost like a little story. Like they weren't quite narrative necessarily, but I could succinctly describe, here's what this painting's about. And then over the years, the concept kind of spread out across a series. So like any one painting, you know, I would give it a title, I would be able to talk about why I structured it the way that I did. At times they would have explicit images, but not always. But it was no longer quite as like simple as like, here's why I made this one painting. It's like, well, here's the notions that I had that led to this body of work, and thematically, you know, I think it has this, but it became a little bit less convenient, I suppose, which I liked. I mean, that to me seemed, one, more sustainable, but also just more interesting, because I felt like the ideas were, like with the urban sociology built environment work, I felt more inclined, or not inclined, but I felt like I was more likely to touch on these things that were sort of like more generic or more universal, that like, you know, other artists within the same conceptual field would also touch on, just because they were like too logical of conclusions. And so I wanted to get away from that and make something that was a little more of like a cloudy reaction to the world than such a concrete like assessment of it. And like over the years, those themes have changed. Like, so from grad school, that was, and for a couple of years beyond that, it was like built environment as a metaphorical revealer of society and its woes and successes. And then it transitioned to like structures as stand-in for human-like figures and all their imperfections and efforts. And that is the series from which the Birchfield has a piece. And then it sort of slowly transitioned into this one series called Contrived Gestures, where I ditched the structural component and it was just these fake drips that I would cut out of masking tape and then spray paint. So it looked like gestural abstract paintings to a degree, but all contrived, and I was relating that to like social interaction and niceties and polite small talk and the like, so these contrived gestures. And then the socialization theme kind of kept as a through line in the next series, where they were all about the marks in the painting as posture and affect and such, to be non-linguistic communicators, like things without words communicating very distinctly in the same way that abstraction could communicate in the absence of an image. And now it's even kind of moving away from that, and I'm not sure yet where it's going, but that was the most recent stopping point for a while.
Here's a question: as somebody who does not consider herself an artist, what's it like having this loose, sort of nebulous motivation, let's say, to like make a work or make a series, but not even to be able to have like a structured articulation of what it is, you know, and yet to like still be able to harness these very loose, sort of all over the place ideas into like the actual hand gestures or physical actions that make a painting or make a piece, let's say.
There's definitely an inertia there. So mm-hmm. like even for really productive artists, if they stop for some amount of time, you really got to get the train going again, and it feels like you're dragging it with a rope. So I'm not sure that I would necessarily like privilege an artist at being able to like transfer that nebulous stuff into like concrete action. Like, I'm sure that happens in ways in your job and in a lot of jobs.
It is true. Like, sometimes you don't know where you're going when you're already on the path, because you've got your blinders on and you're only seeing the next stop
yeah.
down the road, and you don't necessarily know the big picture that it's all adding up to. And that is true.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, like in my work, I have to be able to see the big picture and articulate it, even though there is a valley in between me and there, and I don't have a bridge yet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I have to be able to say very clearly what I want, even if we don't have the capabilities to do it yet.
The idea of translating nebulous mental activity into something tangible, I guess the one difficult thing with doing that in the context of being an artist is just like if you look at that world, if you look at the contemporary art world, and it's why it's the greatest thing in my eyes, but it is all over the place, and the difference between the greatest thing you've ever seen and the worst thing you've ever seen is like a hair thin. It's very slight differences, and it could just be like, oh, they handled it this way, this person didn't. So like, at times that makes it very difficult to motivate yourself to actually act on an idea. But you have to, like, to a degree, like especially in the studio, put your blinders on and act a little bit on faith that what you'll be doing will be worth your time. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not, it's better to have made something.
Yeah, how do you deal with that? That is something I know a lot of local artists deal with, and like something I talk about with Tom Holt a lot, right? He gets dissuaded or disengaged if he sees somebody else working on a similar type of subject matter or something like that to what he does, you know. But my perspective is, well, nobody else is Tom Holt making that. You know, nobody else is like this unique person, even if they're working. Or AJ Fries for a while was working on a graveyard series, right?
Mm-hmm.
And didn't want to look at any other instance of anybody working with graveyards. But everything has been done except for it hasn't been done by you yet.
Yeah.
And that sort of.
Someone had a great quote from a past teacher of mine, Dietmar Kermie. He said, "You can't help but be yourself." So it's like you could try your hardest to even copy somebody, but there will be some fatal mark of yourself in that will undermine that. Mm-hmm. I mean, to a degree, that's totally over-romanticized, but I like that as a guiding principle.
Mm-hmm.
But like the idea of like other people making the same stuff that you do, like, yeah, internet era, there's a million people that make what you do. So you can either be pushed to like crippling anxiety from that, or you can just sort of consider it a community and then figure out like, all right, well, if I'm not satisfied being part of that community, what do I got to change? What other community do I want to be a part of? Or like, how do I, you know, find that hallowed ground of unique ideas, which may or may not exist?
Mm-hmm. Before I go on, I do want to ask you about something that's not on my list here, which is your role as a curator, right? Because you've been working closely with Hall Walls Contemporary Arts Center for the past few years, working on the Amid in Western New York exhibition series. And so, you know, thinking about what is that line between good or less good, how have you found that experience to be, being in the assessment role of other people's work?
That's been interesting. I mean, in the same way that, you know, my working process has changed, like I've gotten really tolerant of my knee-jerk like it or not reactions to artwork. And so like that wasn't too stressful for me. To give some context around that was like the involvement that I've had with curating things in the last 2 years was sort of a weird outlier, or it kind of came out of nowhere. Like I was invited by the curator at Hall Walls, John Massier, to participate in this series, Amid In. And so I've been kind of developing an idea of how I might act as a curator as I've been doing it, and have been working with another gallery, Starlight, for the past year or two. I like artists way more. I really like the curating that we've done, and it was like a entirely positive experience, inevitably, because I think in any town, but in particular in Buffalo, the size that it is, it made, on occasion, some awkward moments just because I was familiar with the art community, and like I want nothing but for all of them to do their best, but we had to pick people to be in the show, and some people didn't get in, so that caused some just a handful of awkward interactions, but nothing real severe. But I don't know exactly what it is about that role of things. I think it's its own creative realm, but I would still like to safeguard my preference for the art side of the fence. that's not to undermine, though, any of the curatorial efforts. Like, one of the more interesting aspects of it was having just so much exposure to the local artists, and like, not just we're both at an opening and we're chatting with cheese and wine, but like them actually having to like explain to us and sort of account for their efforts toward their work has been interesting, because it's like you see behaviors come up a lot, and I felt like now when I have to have a studio visit or prepare for a show or whatever it might be, very fortunately, I'm a little privy into this world and the ways in which people act in those situations, and you know, it helped me get over some you know, like anxieties I might have about studio visits and the like, or just that sort of the realm of being an artist that isn't just making art, like the stuff outside of that. Seeing a lot of people deal with the same issues was interesting, so it kind of like calmed me down in that regard about that side of things.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fascinating series of exhibitions that have been happening. And there are more coming, or is it wrapped up?
It's wrapped up. Okay. Got a catalog coming.
Given the unique perspective you are in for where you are now, can you speak at all to what you have done personally to advance your career in the arts? And I say that very differently from advance yourself as an artist to advance your career as an artist.
Yeah. My conduct in that realm is really bad. Like, I've at least for the last number of years been really bad about applying to things, whether it's like residencies or shows or competitions or jobs, and I'm not particularly schmoozy, so I kind of chuckled a little bit inside when I saw the question. I was like, I feel like I've been particularly bad, and that I've run across a number of great opportunities that have like sort of allowed me to sustain myself as an artist. I think probably the most I've done for myself is just make a lot of things, and always try to like, in terms of scale or ambition or labor, sort of outdo myself and like keep that up, because it's easy to like, once you've made something that you're really gratified with, to be like, all right, I satiated that need, now I can kind of like coast for a bit, which I do here and there, but like I keep on trying to pursue these larger things that hopefully other people will read as like a consistent ambition. And that's probably the most I've done in terms of my career, because in a lot of other ways I've been sort of a failure in terms of pursuing these things that I should be pursuing as far as a career in the arts.
And yet I would say you've had a moderate amount of success in that regard. You know, your work is certainly viewed very favorably, and being invited to be a curator in the amid-in shows and things like that. And well, how did you end up at Villa Maria?
Someone told me about the opening, so I gave him an application, and I'd had a few teaching gigs under my belt before that, mm-hmm. and had a strong recommendation, so
fairly straightforward.
Yeah, pretty straightforward. And then this summer teaching class I had was actually like I was invited by a person that I would be co-teaching with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to imply too much that I'm like some slacker or screw up, but I definitely feel like I've lacked in like, I probably could have like advanced my career in ways that I haven't, but because I sort of like to just roll with the inertia of things, knowing full well that I need to interrupt that at times.
But that's also a form of self-care, in my estimation. You know, it's like, yeah, society tells you you need one thing, which is to, like, chase, chase, chase. But that's actually very unhealthy, you know? And
yeah, I don't want to move to New York.
No. I don't even think that's a good option anymore.
No.
Patti Smith said it best. Is there anything that you hope to achieve with your art?
That's tough, because I don't have the most faith that there would be any good to come of my art that in any way parallels to like the good that will come of what a social worker might do or a counselor. So like, I think there's a ceiling that is well below anything with a much more noble job would do. And I'm more so lately have become kind of preoccupied with just the acknowledgement that for all of its rhetoric about the positive output of art or like the good it does for people or like, oh, the world would be really boring with art, I think that's all very true, but it is a very self-centered field to be an artist, and like you're always, you know, like pushing your own name and pushing your own stuff. And here I am doing an interview. So like that kind of gets to me sometimes. And I would never anticipate or assume that any like great, you know, feelings or realizations or whatever might come to somebody else via something that I made, that would be great. If there's something that I do, you know, more so just as an example for a way to live life, if there's something that, you know, that I'm sort of financially letting my life do what it's going to do, and then I'm otherwise spending my time for the most part how I'd want, if that seems like it could be a reasonable short-term, small example to someone that has similar ambitions, I think that would be great. But I don't think there's any going to be any grand human good to come of anything I've made.
Well, the counter that, to that, I'd say, is that, you know, the social worker gets home at night and is heavy, feeling heavy and probably upset in some regard, and is able to look at one of your works and get lost in it. You know, like, I see that as value. If the social worker can afford your works.
They're online. If you count teaching in the career arts, mm-hmm. I suppose, like, I feel great about that. I mean, and again, I'm not going to assume that I'm going to have too profound of an effect in anybody's lives, but it, like, the good in that is much more apparent. So there's this whole other, like, you know, motivation and reward system to being a teacher. It feels very different to being an artist. Like, artists, there's kind of that antagonism of, like, this feels self-centered. But with teaching, it can still be that, but I don't think it's as apt to be.
Well, I think the challenge is, too, is a lot of art professors lose their awareness of how self-centered it can be, you know, and I think some ways, like, holding on to that awareness and imparting that to, you know, or rather holding on to the awareness of where you are in context of other things and imparting that to students is helpful, you know, and
yeah,
I was having a conversation with two artists the other day about the art programs they went to college for and how they were never taught to hang a painting or to put together a portfolio the whole time they were in art school. You know, they were taught how to paint or whatever, and how actually it was a disservice done to them that their professors didn't teach them how to accurately participate within this capitalistic system that we all exist within. You know, that they were taught techniques but not life skills, you know, as if the professors who have cushy tenure jobs, you know, didn't even think that that's something that other people have to deal with.
There should be, like, art home ec.
There should be art home ec.
That would be great.
That would be so great.
Some schools, I mean, there's, like one day a week classes where they're like, here's how you write a grant application,
mm-hmm.
and such. But usually at the time of doing it, all that stuff is alien enough that the information doesn't quite seem tangible.
Right.
Which
totally.
Is not the fault of the teachers. But, yeah, I think there's... I think there's kind of a minor plague amongst academic artists. That's a weird term itself. Like, people that are, like, sort of independently successful in the art world, and maybe that is a factor in why they have the prestigious teaching job that they have. But there's a plague of conduct, I think, amongst people like that. And not by any means everybody, maybe not even most, but, like, it's its own weird world and weird language of making art, and it kind of sustains itself in a number of ways that can be aggravating, because
mm-hmm.
it's a self-contained value system.
Mm-hmm. These last questions are about what you need from the community to kind of help us continue to gauge what we are trying to offer other than exhibition space. So what are some of your needs specifically to you as an artist that the larger community either can or has provided you with?
That's tough, because when I think of, like, the community as a thing, as a chunk, I have a hard time pinpointing, like, specific things that the community has done aside from, like, be an attending, supportive entity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can think of individuals who have, like, you know, because they have resources or because they have time or knowledge, whatever it might be, who have, like, themselves as part of the art community, perhaps, but, like, lended whatever it might be, like, a space for making something on rare occasion, a little bit of resources or funds to make something or whatever it might be. As far as stuff that they can provide, like, I'm trying to think of something that would be even, like, a useful encapsulation of that.
It can be money. That's what a lot of people say, you know, is more galleries, patrons.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, I think always more of everything whenever we can spare it and whenever it's feasible. In, like, specific places, that becomes so complicated because there's, like, weird little, you know, they're like ecosystems and new galleries. A gallery leaving, a gallery coming in, can, like, sort of displaces things, especially in a smaller community. And I think more in the lines of like, there's a bit of art career self-promotion that comes with even starting a space, for sure. So like, everybody and their sister wants to start a nonprofit art space to a degree. Not really. That's a really cynical way of saying it. But like, I've seen spaces open up and close, and like after it was done, you're like, well, that was useful, and they had this like community-minded mission. But like, was that what they were doing? You know, even other people that are I don't want to go down too cynical of a road, but I don't know. To me, that seems like a really tough question to answer, because like, they are providing a million things already in a very like informal way, by being there, by saying things, by giving feedback. And hopefully I'm doing the same by going to events, by supporting people, by like contributing to their Kickstarter, by buying work. So like, all of that adds up, and like, you can sort of, in a very informal sense, assess like, is the community doing what I need it to do in order to like sustain me or keep here? And I think like in Buffalo, that community seems pretty strong. Like, I don't know that, I haven't lived in other cities, so I don't really know, but from what I understand, it's not that way necessarily everywhere, even in like-sized places. Do you have quite as supportive of a community, or like, you know, as many people that own buildings that would be willing to like host big crazy art parties or exhibitions? Or do you have like business actors that are, you know, donating as much as they do? Not that it's like all sunshine and flowers mm-hmm. in Buffalo, but you know, I've gotten plenty from this community, and hopefully have given a fair amount as well.
One thing, yeah, those statements made me think of is the upcoming grand opening of the Pineapple Company tomorrow, right? And so in some ways, like, that is a direct growth of like Tom being involved with the Kamikaze Gallery back in the early 2000s, which was totally self-promotion for all these young MFA students at UB. Do you know anything about the Kamikaze?
Mm-mm.
Oh, wow.
How long ago was that?
Oh my gosh, that was right before I moved to town, so it's like 2003.
Okay.
And they essentially, do you know the building next to Maureen's flower shop down on Ellicott or Washington or whatever that is? They got it for a song in 2003 to rent it, and so they rented it as living space or studio space or something, and got the whole first floor as well, and just had this big gallery space. And so it really was only active for 6 months, but they would do like two or three shows a month.
Wow.
And it was really both promoting their own weird video art in a lot of ways, but also all sorts of different performance art and exhibitions, and just really avant-garde, just beyond the edge stuff. Of course, they lost the space pretty quickly, and most of the people left town, and Tom's one of the few who stuck around, and like, I've heard these stories from him and from other people who were able to go to those shows at the time. So I see, like, in some ways, self-promotion is important. Brian Milbrand is one of those people who has started the Kamikaze with Tom.
Oh, okay.
And just even the space to be as weird as you want, you know, if it's like an artist-run space, I think there's more understanding of those levels of weirdness. Yeah. But now with Pineapple Company and with College Street gone finally, you know, I don't even just look at it as is it self-serving to the artist, but also on a bigger picture, like, is it self-serving to the street it's on? You know, when College Street closed, and I love you, Mike, but, you know, it was a pay-to-play cooperative type, collective type structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the art was good and some of the art was terrible, but I didn't know any other gallery that would put up acrylic paintings of dinosaur love scenes anywhere in town, you know? And now to have that there does feel like that neighborhood is able to hold on to some of those creative roots, even at a time when gentrification is coming closer and closer and closer to the door.
Yeah.
You know?
And anytime someone takes, I mean, like, talk of self-promotion or not, like, no one's a saint, everybody does it, and anytime anybody like puts up that much material, and you know, it's like a risk to start a mm-hmm. physical actual gallery, so if you're going for it, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like in that collective sort of atmosphere.
Yeah.
Five or six people running it.
Yeah. And I think it is a double-edged sword. I don't think that artists are encouraged to, I think that artists, especially in this Western context, have a lot of self-deprecation, have a lot of you know, feelings of not being good enough or not being good enough to promote themselves in ways like that, and also the ways in which promoting oneself is so commercialized, let's say, and put within this marketing perspective that feels really uncomfortable to a lot of artists. But I think there's a middle ground where it's like you can promote yourself and what you like about your work and what you like about what you're doing without completely either selling out or needing to hate yourself, you know. And I don't know what that sweet spot is, but
yeah, I don't know either.
I think it's different for every artist.
I think most people are like somewhere in that sweet spot. Like, it's not that often that I meet someone who is like so egregious about trying to talk someone up in order to get some opportunity or another that
mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, I don't want to be that. And I'm, you know, at moments I probably get that far, but I don't think very often. But yeah, most people like aren't too like flagrant or inflammatory about it, I would
mm-hmm.
assume.
But I think a lot of artists could love themselves more.
Sure.
And that's what I...
No reason to not have faith in what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, this perhaps is a silly question for you, but for where you are now, what do you think you need to advance your artistic career?
I think I just need to start like reaching out a bit more. And like I talked about earlier, how I haven't made much of a practice of applying to things over the last few years, but now I've started changing that because like, to a degree, there is a ceiling in Buffalo, and it's like you either get a show, you know, like hypothetically, you get as high as getting a show at the Albright Knox. That's kind of like the most you can advance if that's how you prioritize
mm-hmm.
the different institutions in town. That's not to say that you can't continue. Like, I don't ever want to live in a place and not be a participating artist, because I wouldn't want to not have that immediate like interaction and payoff and feedback. But, you know, I got to make sure that I don't, in whatever way, stagnate too much just by, you know, being comfortable and enjoying myself in the place that I am. So I'm trying to figure out how can I secure opportunities outside of Buffalo, which, you know, again, comes back to the networking thing, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But just for the short term, I'm just simply, like, applying to a number of things here and there, a couple a month maybe. And then in a year, we'll see what things I have on my plate.
Mm-hmm. I know Dreamland, I don't know how tight you are with Dreamland, but Dana McKnight is trying to start up an artist exchange with some art collectives in Japan, where it's really, so they currently
have... That'd be nuts.
Yeah.
I really like Dreamland a lot. I don't know him that well, but I'm a huge fan of Dana McKnight.
She's so awesome. So my last question is, for some people, the hardest question I ask, and so I ask it two ways. The question as it's written is, what advice do you have for emerging artists? But some people really balk at that because it's like, well, I don't know the person. I don't know who, you know, like that's such a broad thing. And so if you don't want to answer that, my alternative question, though of course you also don't have to answer any of it, but my alternative question is, what advice would you have given yourself? The alternative question is, what advice would you have given yourself when you first graduated from UB or even from your undergrad?
It is tough, but only because I can only think of like the generic things that you would hear, like, you know, develop a thick skin, keep with it, just work all the time, which we've all heard them a million times. They're kind of useless. So all of that, all of the things that you would think I should say,
yada yada yada,
yada yada yada. But then when it comes to the specific advice, that's tough. I'm drawing a blank. There's like a really distinct benefit that comes from just like simple exposure, and that, you know, if you think of like the word naive kind of exists, it seems like a very useful word to me, but I think it applies here in the sense that you can sort of like circumvent a certain duration of being a naive young person, which everybody is bound to be, and to a degree always is. You're never quite past it, but, you know, it increasingly lessens. So like just like hyper exposure to things, and like, you know, we have the internet, so like you can always do that. So just like paying as much attention as possible, just so you're always like continually catching up. And it's an asymptote. You can never actually reach that point. It will always be beyond your grasp. But one thing that I've come to tell students in class is like there's a threshold you pass where like after you've looked at like 10 million paintings or whatever, suddenly your priorities really drastically change. And you're like, the things that I like now are really different from what I liked when I was 18 or when I was 20. And I kind of like, I also think that every 2 years I'm totally embarrassed by the person that I was 2 years prior and feel confident enough right now, but I know that when I'm 33, I'll be embarrassed by who I am right now. That's consistent and reliable. So I always feel like you're always like only ever at the vanguard of being naive. But like you can work against that, and you can always like, again, hyper expose yourself to things to sort of like quicken the pace of that development towards like whatever, towards maturity or towards a more developed opinion or towards a taste that feels more comfortable or more you, whatever it might be. And like exposure might be like literally looking at watching that, listening to things, or even exposing yourself to your own work processes. So just like be quick, don't fret, and move on to the next thing.
Kyle, we're at the end of our questions, but is there anything else you'd like to add before we conclude this interview?
No, just thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much, and thank you for participating in the Living Legacy Project at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center.
Thank you.